Well, hello there, I'm Adrian Eames. Welcome along to the RTÉ Soccer Podcast. No James O'Toole today, but we'll be helped along the way by Ronnie Whelan, Pat Phelan and Gary Rogers. We'll be chatting Euros with Ronnie, Pat and Gary also here. We'll be chatting Talca Park days with Tony Sheridan. I'm sure Pat has many great memories of the old venue. The Save Talca campaign is launched, of course, to preserve the ground, which has been part of Dublin since 1924. And we'll also hear from Vinnie Perth on his return to Oriel Park as manager of Dundalk. But let's start by chatting Euros. Ronnie's on the line. Ronnie, of course, great hero of the 88 campaign, Ireland's maiden voyage in European and world football. Ronnie, has it been a good tournament so far, in your opinion?
Well, how are you doing, Adrian?
Good.
For me, it's been magnificent. I think there's been some great football played. Refereeing has been good. VAR has not messed up games. So all in all, it's been a good tournament.
Yeah, would you share that view, Pat? Because generally, you know, and obviously the business end is to come, so you'd have to anticipate it's going to just get better and better. But so far, so good, surely.
No, absolutely. I agree with Ronnie there. I think the games have been really good. I was probably a little bit worried at the start where so many teams could qualify for the next phase, but it's worked out quite well where, you know, the groups have been really competitive. And like Ronnie says, I think the big point for me is that VAR have not been involved and it hasn't disrupted the game too much and people have been allowed joy it. And we've seen goal celebrations. And obviously with the return of spectators to games, it's been a big help.
Gary, are you happy with the tournament so far? And VAR has worked well so far in the tournament, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, it's been really good. I think, you know, once VAR isn't interfering too much, I think people are happy. Like, the main thing for me is the supporters and the atmosphere that are back of the games. And obviously, look, we've had really good games and goals and all the groups are competitive. So that's really what you want. I think it's great to see. Obviously, the business end is to come and the games, I suppose, intensify then when it's knockout football. That's a completely different game. And it'll be interesting to see who stands up to that test.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's chat about some of the nations who we would expect to be at the business end of the competition. Ronnie, you were fortunate enough to be at Wembley on Friday night for England-Scotland. What have you made of England so far? Because they haven't really clicked. Are you surprised by the sluggishness of England so far?
I am surprised, but it was also great to be back at the ground with crowds in. Great atmosphere at Wembley. But I just don't know which way England are going or which way they want to go. Struggling up top with Sterling and Kane not doing an awful lot, and then even Foden and Mount at Wembley didn't play. The thing also is that the English crowd started going on them very, very quickly. We've seen this before, but I don't know if the likes of Foden and Mount have seen this. They'll struggle if the crowd are getting behind them. And then you've got to look at, will they change the way they're playing? They're playing two in midfield, Holden, Phillips and Rose. Is it needed? It's England, they're playing at Wembley. Put one in there and then put Grealish on instead of Phillips or Rice and then start to attack more. They run out of ideas against Scotland and just looked not a unit at all.
Pat, what have you made of England and do you still think they're potential winners given what we've seen so far?
Yeah, listen, I think it's like England when they get to major tournaments, it's that expectancy and they try to dampen it down. But I think the interesting thing with England is coming into the tournament, personally, I was thinking, you know, can they cope defensively when they do get to the latter stages, when they come up against the bigger nations and the better quality? And it's actually the top end of the pitch where we thought, you know, they've got some real attacking flair. But they, like Ronnie said, they haven't linked and they haven't fired at all. You know, the likes of Foden and Sterling and Kane, players we expected probably to light up the tournament for England, haven't done that. And that expectancy, I know people talk about the home advantage at Wembley, but with the England crowd, it can be a negative for them as well, because like we've seen with Scotland, once Scotland nullified that threat, the crowd started to turn on them. So it's a big game coming up for them as well, because the Czech Republic have played well, you know, so it's not an easy game for England.
Yeah, absolutely not. What have you made of England, Gary?
Yeah, look, they've been disappointing. I think England always kind of flatter to deceive in terms of qualification. They qualify really comfortably generally in a lot of tournaments. And then when you get to the tournament, then, like, I remember Rooney having a flat campaign maybe 10 years ago, and there was a lot of hype about him. And like, he was obviously a fantastic player, but he never produced his best stuff in a tournament. And now you've got the same kind of scenario with Kane at the minute, has yet to really light it up. And that's going to be a huge problem. I think, you know, that Scotland worked really, really hard and nullified England, and England didn't have the answers. And like Pat says, the Czech Republic looked like a really good outfit and they beat Scotland quite comfortably. So this is really going to be a very, very difficult game for England, because they have to go and win it, and the Czech Republic will be there to win it. So that could be a really exciting match.
Ronnie, did you think in terms of Harry Kane, the weight of captaincy, and there's a lot of talk about his own future and, you know, if he's going to stay at Tottenham or not, do you think it's too much for him that the pressure's getting to him?
I don't know whether it's that completely. Liam and Diddy in studio touched on early on that this could be all weighing him down. Is he still struggling with the injury he had to his ankle? Because he's not got the best ankles in the world. He's also not had a lot of service as a centre forward. He's been dropping into midfield to get a kick or two, which is not where you want Harry Kane. You want him up forward in around the box. But the whole speculation of where he's going to go, the price tag, is he frightened to get more injured that he won't get his move away? I think it's just weighing him down. I'd even try this next game against the Czechs. Start off with no Harry Kane, go to false number nine, what they say. Put Sterling in the false number nine and put the young lads Grealish in and put them behind them, and use the pace of Sterling to see if he can break teams down.
And leave Harry Kane on the bench, yeah?
Well, he's not doing an awful lot during the games, the two games we've seen. So it's not going to be a huge thing to everybody if he's just left out. He can be brought on later on if need be. But if he's not scoring and not playing, not really contributing, you've got to look somewhere else.
And Ronnie, you have to give Scotland great credit for their performance on Friday night. And they're still in with a fighting chance. They obviously have to beat Croatia and probably register a few goals to improve their goal difference. But it was a very, very fine performance from them.
Yeah, fighting chance. But they were brilliant right from the off. I think it was O'Donnell, first tackle, went through someone. Shaw, I think it was. And you think, OK, they're up for it. This is going to be difficult for England. But then when they wanted or needed to play football, Scotland, they put the ball down and they passed it. They created a good couple of chances. So it's not dead and buried for them. But I was really impressed with them. I was delighted how they played at Wembley. And the manager couldn't have been any happier than what they did for him.
And Pat, from your own days in Scottish football, you'll know how important the national team is to Scottish supporters. And they were like the Irish fans in London on Friday. Getting up to all sorts of hijinks, yeah. But they were brilliant, the Scottish fans. But Scotland as a team, what did you make of their display?
Yeah, listen, you would have expected it up against England at Wembley, you know, no less that they were going to be at the game, and they were, but, you know, they showed some real quality as well when they're on the ball. I just think this tournament might be a little bit early for that Scotland team that they have built, because they've got some real good players coming through. And again, there's expectancy on them now after a good performance against England to back that up with a real good performance on a win against Croatia. They're a little bit short for me at the top end of the pitch in relation to scoring goals. You know, they've got to take the chances that come their way. They didn't do that against the Czech Republic, you know, and I don't think they've got that clinical striker still at the moment, but they've got real, real talent around the rest of the pitch, really in midfield. They're very, very strong. But like I said, they may be building for something better in the future.
And Billy Gilmour has certainly enhanced his reputation, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's a top player. I mean, we've seen that, I think, in the glimpses when he came into the Chelsea team last year early, and he looked like an experienced centre midfielder. He dominated some of the games he played in for such a young boy, you know. So I think, again, like I say, another one for the future. They've got that midfield area. They are really, really strong, you know, and that's where they I thought they dominated against England and controlled the game at times. So, but it's just the top end I'm a little bit concerned about. Have they got that clinical striker? I don't see it at the moment.
Gary, you're probably feeling good about yourself, because on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, you tipped France. Wow. But you also said keep an eye on Wales,
insightful.
And they're through. Yeah. But they're through Wales. They got there.
Yeah, no, they'd be really happy. Look, obviously, Wales are a solid outfit, but they have that bit of X factor with Ramsey and Bale and, you know, that creative edge. And I know Bale missed a kind of a sitter against Italy. But I think, unlike Scotland, like Wales had that spark in order to get goals, where Scotland are really, I suppose, well organised, and they've really good strong midfield and players in defence, and you look at Robertson and Tierney and Billy Gilmour, as I said, all really good players, high energy, but they're lacking probably that Bale or Ramsey that Wales have. So that's why you kind of fancy Wales maybe to get a couple of results, because they have that sort of quality in the front areas, and that's where it's going to come down to. So like them through to the knockout stages, if they can stay in the games, they have that kind of X factor that might get them a win.
Ronnie, who were you tipping before the start? Because a lot of people were in the French boat, but Italy have obviously impressed so many people. But before the tournament, were you in the France camp?
I think I was, but I can't exactly remember. I'll say I was now.
Well, which camp are you in now?
I'm in the Italy camp, definitely.
Yeah.
Now. I think they look so, so strong. You know, at the back when you've got Bonucci, Chiellini's carrying an injury, but Bonucci at the back, and then they're young, they're hungry, they close down, it is. Somebody mentioned it somewhere recently that it looks like a Man City team, a Pep Guardiola team, where they close down and get the ball back quick up front. I've been very impressed with them. But the thing is, you look at Italy and you're thinking, oh, who's the great centre-forward? Who's the best midfielder? And then you're looking at one who's playing the best football is the left-back. Spinazzola, he's up and down that line. Mm. He's getting crosses in. He's defending. He's been very, very impressive. So I think anybody who wants to win it will have to play very, very well if they want to beat Italy.
Yeah, Pat, they're looking good, aren't they, Italy?
Yeah, they've been very strong. I think going to Ronnie's comments there, it's interesting, isn't it? You can't really pick out a real dominant player for them over the years. You would have always picked out dominant, but they're just a team unit. They work so hard for each other, you know, and they give possession away. They work so hard to get the ball back as well. So they've been really, really impressive. And they sailed through their group and scoring plenty of goals, and defensively they're so strong. We're a really good goalkeeper as well, so they have looked good. But I still think Germany, I wouldn't write Germany out of it either. I think, you know, they're a little bit lucky in the first game to lose it in the end, and they showed real quality, I think, in their game against Portugal when they had to. And again, France are such a good team as well. Again, workman-like, real, real strong physical presence in the team, and pace. They've got pace to burn at the top end of the pitch, so some real quality still in the tournament, obviously.
Yeah, it's been a low-key start, Gary, from, you know, your team, France. But you still expect more. There's more to come from them, surely, isn't there?
Yeah, there certainly is. And you know, their next game against Portugal is going to be a very interesting game. But France, yeah, like Portugal, obviously, you know, they've got goals in them. But Germany, I suppose, highlighted their defensive frailties. I think Germany were exceptional in that game, and even Germany were probably the better side in the France game. You know, France scored and they kind of sat in, but Germany really dominated the possession. And in general, you know, Germany had 60% possession, and that, you know, when they played against France and Portugal, that's a fair chunk of possession. So you're going to expect them to kind of to do well because of the quality that they have. But it's about getting out of that group, and it is such a tough group. And the France-Portugal game, it will be an intriguing game.
Yeah, Germany, of course, were my dark horses. If you can ever call Germany in a tournament dark horses. What about some of the rest, Ronnie? Any standouts? Obviously, Belgium have to have a big shout.
Yeah.
The Netherlands might be too soon for them.
The Netherlands, but more for me, Belgium. When you watch them against Denmark the other night, 1-0 down early on, they're struggling a bit in the game. They bring De Bruyne on at half-time, quick into the game up a bit, and they bring Hazard, Witsel on, and then they just go into top gear and win the game fairly easily in the end. But because De Bruyne and Witsel, Hazard are all back in now, I think you've got to give Belgium a big chance.
Would you share that view, Pat? Belgium right in it?
Oh, absolutely. The quality they have, and them three players obviously coming back into the business end of the tournament as well. And, you know, I think they're probably a bit like Germany in that regard. You're probably looking at their defensive unit and thinking, is that where they may get caught out? You know, again, I think the centre-halves are probably pace-wise, they struggle very similar to Germany, but at the top end of the pitch, they've got so much quality. Like, you know, like De Bruyne coming back in is a huge lift for them, isn't it? As Ronnie said, in the game against Denmark, they looked very flat as soon as, you know, it just changed and they went through the gears fairly quickly, and they were really, really impressive then in the second half.
Gary, your thoughts on Belgium? Do you see them being there or thereabouts like many people do?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, you looked at Belgium's group, it was always, you know, one that you thought Belgium are going to get out of the group. So, and they look like they're coming right, obviously, with De Bruyne coming on. It was like he's such an influential player, like he's going to be pivotal to them in the run-in. But I also think, like, you look at Spain, like Spain haven't done it yet, and they've got to play Slovakia as well. Spain have dominated possession, but just haven't been able to get the goals. You know, that like they obviously play lovely football, but they need to start getting the goals, and they've got Slovakia coming up in their next game to get through as well.
Ronnie, I guess it's still quite early. We're only into the second week of the competition, but has there been a player that's stood out for you or somebody that's caught your eye in particular?
Well, I've spent this all day, didn't I? Because of the way he's forward and creates chances. But then the wing-back now, the way the game's played, you look at Dumfries with the Netherlands, and he's getting forward all the time as well. These players cause an awful lot of trouble. You know, but going forward at the right time, coming into attack at the right time, getting behind the opposite fullback, getting crosses in and scoring goals. And I think the two of them, Spinazzola and Dumfries, have been absolutely really, really pivotal to what the teams are doing.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Pat, anybody standing out for you? Gosens of Germany has been quite impressive, hasn't he?
Yeah, there has been, but I think the there's nobody really for me that's grabbed the tournament yet and has been a real highlight. I think what's been impressive is sometimes we look at the likes of France and maybe Italy at times with individual players and you think that individual flair they have, but just the team units that they have at the moment, particularly probably Italy, that they've shown, you know, that they are such a good unit together, and whatever Mancini has done with them, they've got that attitude at the moment. They're whether they're in attacking mode or they have to defend, which we know they've always done well defensively, but they just, for me, as a unit rather than individual players at the moment, it's I think when we come into the next part of the competition where the top teams will end up playing each other, well then it's up to the really big players, you know, to grab games and show their real quality.
Okay. Gary, are you sticking with France to win it?
Look, I think it's I'll be a bit stubborn. I've obviously picked them early doors. I'm not gonna change my mind now. The group hasn't even been settled. But yeah, I think they've got that progression in them. Look, they have got great quality and that hasn't changed. If they can get out of the group, you'd like to think that they will grow into the tournament, and they've obviously got real experienced players that have done it before. So you would like to think that they will get better as the tournament goes on. I think I stick with them for now, but Italy have been very impressive and has of Germany. So like you see with the form in the tournament and how teams progress, and you often get teams that turn up like that and get a good, put a good run together. A bit like the Czech Republic and Karol Poborský back in the day, where he took the tournament by storm. But I stick with France for now.
Okay. Ronnie, I guess your vote, you're sticking with Italy, are you?
I'll go with Italy. But France, if Benzema and Mbappe start to score, will be very, very hard as well. And Belgium. So Italy, France or Belgium. I'm taking three.
All right. How many do you want to take, Pat? you take four. Listen,
I think you're going into the rest of this tournament. There's probably, there is five or six teams you probably have a realistic chance of winning the tournament, which is brilliant. I think I sort of still have a sneaky suspicion that Germany won't be far away when it's coming around to giving it out. But I'm gonna go with France because I think defensively they're really, really strong and they've got so much power and pace at the top of the pitch that we even seen, and I know Germany dominated against them in the second half, you know, but they broke away on three or four occasions with that pace as well and caused them problems. So, you know, it's Germany or France for me.
Okay. All right, lads, we leave the Euros there. Ronnie, before we let you go, can I just ask you, whenever Irish fans meet you, even right up to this day, do they still talk to you about the goal against the Soviet Union back in 88?
All they ever say is it was a shinner. That's all.
What do you say?
still scored against the best goalkeeper in the world at the time.
Yeah. Show me your international caps, lads. Yeah. No, it was a great strike. Yeah. Great day. All right, Ronnie. Listen, many thanks for joining us. That's Ronnie Whelan, part of the RTE team on the coverage of the European Championships of 2020. Now, of course, taking place in 2021. We're not going to dwell too long on the SSE Electricity League because as we record this on a Monday, there are a full round of matches taking place on Monday evening. But just to run through the results from Friday. Watford won, Shamrock Rovers 4. Watford took the lead through Eric Malloy, but Graham Burke with 2, the first to penalty, Rory Gaffney and Aaron Green. So Shamrock Rovers setting the pace once again at the top of the table. Big performance from Georgie Kelly for Bowes, scoring 4 in a 5-0 win over Drogheda United. Will Patching on the mark twice for Derry City in their 2-1 win over Finn Harps at Finn Park. So the North West bragging rights on this occasion going to Derry City. St Pat's 2, Sligo Rovers 0. Matty Smith with an early goal. Ronan Coughlin against his old club for Pats. Pats winning that one by 2-0. And at Oriel Park, Dundalk 1, Longford Town 1. Chris Shields with equaliser for Dundalk. So Vinnie Perth back at Oriel for a second spin on the merry-go-round. And after the game, he spoke with Pat Costello.
Very proud of the performance, I think. I don't want to say a typical Dundalk performance, but it was close to that in many ways, or attack and play, or stylistically, and fullbacks bombing on. And look, we had to ride our luck a little bit. I've only had sort of 2 training sessions with the guys, -2, -1 days. Very difficult, but what I seen out of them was real sort of bit of passion, desire. They fought for the badge tonight, and there was a togetherness about the club. And I think it's a positive night. We're not going to celebrate a 1-1 draw against anybody in this league. I thought Longford, you know, were really good and made it difficult for us. And we had the right of luck once or twice. But I think on chances created, I think you win that game 99 times out of 100. And it's just one unfortunate night for us.
Was there a bit of lack of confidence or anxiousness early on?
Yeah, I think, look, I thought we started well in terms of the front foot, and we were driving. It was a warm day. It took us a while, because actually Longford get around the place really well and they're set up. Remember, this team's confidence has been shot, and they have to rebuild that, and we have to do it step by step. But I thought there was a huge amount of positives there in terms of both our fullbacks were so attacking, and I think that's great to see. And I think another night, Pat Hoobin scores 5 or 6, and look, he's been outstanding for me since I've come back into the club in the last sort of 72 hours. And I know he's gutted that he hasn't ultimately won the game for us. But look, it's a long road back for Dundalk. We've been in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. And it's about time now just be a bit safer and steady the ship and get back on the road and climb our way back to where we belong.
We watched from the sidelines the soap opera, so to speak, of the managerial situation in Dundalk over the last few months. Were you able to watch dispassionately?
It was difficult, like, because I mean there was things said that were factually untrue. My wife brought a newspaper article into me which said I would be manager 48 hours, which was 10-12 days ago. At that stage I hadn't spoken to club and anyone from the club in 10-12, maybe 2 weeks. So people, we live in a war now of clickbait, and it's difficult, and it's difficult for journalists, but because so many people have different podcasts and all of this stuff, and it's a difficult war. But the only way I can explain it to you is this is the war we live in. Sky Sports have been really backing England and really supporting them, and then the day of the game at 10 o'clock in the morning, breaking news tells the England are playing a back four, and it tells the whole world what the team is. That's the war we live in now. It's a race to be forced, and a lot of untruths have been said. All I can do is come away from social media. I haven't read a newspaper, haven't even listened to my great friend Maria Crowe at 6 o'clock talking about sports, because I just had to ignore it, and I just had to concentrate on my own life, which I was getting on with. And then in the last sort of 72 hours or sort of since Monday evening, it became a reality. The request was there, I accepted it, and we've got on with it.
Yeah, there were lots of speculation, as you say. People had the job, people didn't have it. But you seem to, according to the speculation anyway, you seem to have the ear and the eye of Bill Holzhauser.
No, well, I mean, that again, that's the speculation. I mean, to explain my relationship with Bill Holzhauser and was over a year ago when he really came into the club, COVID-19 hit. Bill is 78, I think. He's still 78. He was living in Florida. I think we all know what happened in America to a lot of people over 70 years of age. I checked in on him almost every day to make sure he was well while I was still manager here. I made the comment that we have a relationship. We do. We speak once a month, over maybe every 6 weeks. I don't have the ear to him. We fight like cats and dogs when we have to. But ultimately, I hadn't spoken to him a lot in the last sort of 4 or 6 weeks, and as much as people think so. I can't change the speculation. I can only deal with the world I live in.
Again, the talk was there was a lot of chaos in the club. How have you found it in the last, 72 hours? Is there chaos or is it settled?
look, on the pitch hasn't been good enough. The players accept that, okay? The noise around the club hasn't helped them, to be fair. But since I've come in, Jim Adjelton, as sporting director, something I called for a year ago, the director of football stroke, whatever the title is, since I've come in, the football side of the club and everything I've asked for or requested or, you know, where we with players and different things, he's already ahead of what I'm asking for. So he's doing the work. It's ready and it makes my job easier. And actually, in fact, now I can be more of a coach on the pitch than manager of the club, which I was 12 months ago. For me, that's a massive improvement.
You have long-term injuries in Daniel Cleary and Brian Gartland. The situation with Chris Shields, your goal scorer tonight?
Yeah, we look, there's no doubt the squad has to be rebuilt. I haven't had it. All myself and Chris have done is worked tirelessly on how to improve the team ahead of tonight. I'll sit down with them over the next couple of days and we'll decide where that one is going. He's been a stalwart for this club for a long, long time, but so has Brian Gartland and Dan Cleary's been excellent. So we are struggling in a couple of areas and we need to fix that, but I think that will come.
You're working with Jim Magilton, as you say now. That's a different situation for you, but it's, as you say, it's something you called for.
Yeah, I called for it. So what can I say? It's modern day football, particularly with so many guys from outside of Ireland. There's a lot of agents making contact. There's a lot of people want to know about your players. And what can you do? Jim has dealt with all that stuff. So, I mean, I had a meeting with him. I've had many meetings with him, but I had a meeting with him where I asked him a question. And he'd already been working on what I was asking him 5 days in advance. So that tells me my job is going to be a lot easier in this football club going forward. And so it's a positive. Honestly, it's a real, real positive.
Last time round, you had a great working relationship with John Gill. Have you finalised your coaching staff at this stage? Is John likely to be part of it?
No. So just to end speculation, because that's the problem of the world we live in. No, John has some other avenues in his life that he wants to pursue. So it's not even a discussion, because I know John is probably the most loyal man you'll ever meet in Irish football. I don't think there's enough of them around anymore, but he has his own sort of goals and what he wants in his own life. There's people here under contract. They've been so helpful to me. Over the next sort of week, 10 days, I'll assess what's here and what I need. I need a slightly different coach because, as I said, I'm not the manager anymore. I'm the head coach, picking the team and being out in the training ground. So I don't need to do as much work away from the pitch. So we'll assess that when the right time comes.
Finally, Vinny, what really attracted you to come back to here to Oriel Park?
Well, look, I don't think it's any secret I'm a massive League of Ireland fan. When my beloved team, like Shamrock Rovers, which they're not, obviously, but when they play in Europe, I hope they do well. I really wish them well. I'm a League of Ireland fan, but I suppose I've had two clubs in my life of real note, well, three. So I was 10 years at Cherry Orchard. I was about 8.5 years Longford Town, been 8.5 years. I'm a very loyal person. I feel I owe them something. I feel I'm culpable for where they are to a point. And this is an opportunity to give something back. The board agreed with that decision. Or they made that decision, should I say. And I'm going to try and repay them as best I can.
And that's Vinnie Perth speaking to Pat Costello on Friday night. Gary, there had been a lot of murmurings that Vinnie was going back in. Are you surprised or did you expect that to happen?
I don't think you can ever be surprised when it comes to Dundalk these days. You just wouldn't know what would happen. But look, it's been, I suppose, on the horizon over the last few weeks. There's plenty of rumours out there that he was going in, and obviously Dave Rogers was in contention as well. So look, Vinny has, you know, he's been clear he's wanted the job. I think, you know, since it came up, he's made his opinion known on that, and obviously now he's got the job. And in fairness, like, Vinny knows the club and he knows the situation he's going into now, and he's obviously dealt with all that before, so he knows that he has to perform. Like, he can have no excuses on it, because it's a case of, there's probably nobody knows the situation better than Vinny up there, in terms of what's going on in behind the scenes in the club, and obviously the issues that they've had. So he knows all that and is very familiar with it, and now he has to kind of go in and do the job and get the results that they want and he wants.
Yeah, it'll probably take him a little bit of time, will it, Pat, just to reacquaint himself. It was interesting, though, that his team selection on Friday night was very much along the lines of, you know, the tried and trusted, the lads he would have known, like Darragh Leahy getting a start at left back, who had been, you know, maybe on the periphery in recent weeks. But he's got a big job on his hands, but at least, as Gary says, he knows the setup and he knows the players.
Yeah, I probably agree with all that, Adrian, but I'm very surprised that Finney's actually gone back into Dundalk, to be honest, because I'm not surprised it's happened. But I think when Finney was going, or did go in the end, there was a lot of talk that it was interference from outside in relation to what he was trying to do. You know, and from first hand experience, he can't have that. You know, he's got to be the manager now, he's got a director of football as such in the club as well. So I am surprised. I wish him the best of luck. You know, it's a tough job at the moment. This is a great football club. They still have a strong squad. But he needs to be the boss, you know, and if that's not the case, then it can cause problems. So but I think you will see him probably go back to Detroit and trust to the players he knows. And obviously with a transfer window coming up, he will want to maybe strengthen the squad and bring in players, which I'd imagine he'll be allowed to do.
I guess, as Pat says there, Gary, that's perhaps what surprised a lot of outsiders, because, you know, he left essentially on, you know, points of principle about interference. Now, in the interview with Pat, he said, you know, there's a lot of stuff being out there in social media. It's played its part in terms of the way people look at Dundalk. But, you know, nonetheless, he left the club last summer, and was at that stage, you couldn't have imagined this particular scenario coming around again, whereby he'd be returning to the hot seat.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's out there. In fact, the terms of like why he left, like he was vocal about the fact that he wasn't happy with the interference. Now, you can look back now and say that it wasn't that bad, but like it was the reason why he left, you know. And, you know, it is a difficult situation to be going back into. But like I said, like Vinny is aware of that, and he's made that decision. He wants the job. He wanted to go back in there. He thinks he can fix it. And now he has to go and do that. And I think, whether he can bring players in or not remains to be seen. I know they're looking at it, but another interesting thing is the relationship between him and Jim, because, you know, if it's a case that, you know, it's been widely reported that Jim wanted Dave Rogers for the job, I know that they put out a video saying that Vinny and Jim are working together and they're all happy campers, but it you know, that remains to be seen. Like, if it's a case that, you know, Jim was overruled in his decision and, you know, and Vinny was given the job ahead of Jim's choice, I think it's a difficult situation for everyone, you know. And look, I think the league needs a vibrant Dundalk and a successful Dundalk in order to push the standards. And I think, you know, the reason that the league has progressed over the last number of years between Cork and Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers is because Dundalk were so successful and they were challenging teams to get better. And now Shamrock Rovers have taken on that mantle. But in order for Shamrock Rovers to continue improving, you need to be challenged by the top teams as well.
Okay, all right, listen, we'll leave the Dundalk situation there and move on, because we want to chat about one of the great Dublin footballing venues, not just Dublin footballing venues, but Irish footballing venues, Talca Park. It's been at the heart of football in this country for many a day, originally, of course, built and founded in 1924. But as it stands, it's to be sold, with Shelburne in line to move into a newly developed Dailyman Park alongside Bohemians. But the Save Talca Park campaign is up and running. They want the famous old ground, those involved, to be retained and developed as a community hub. And I'm delighted to say we're joined on the RT Soccer podcast by a man who graced the Talca Park surface with great distinction and undoubtedly one of the finest players to grace the League of Ireland for many a year, Tony Sheridan. How you doing, Tony?
I'm good, yeah. I'm good, yourself?
Good. Yeah, not too bad. Well, I gave you the big up there, you know, in terms of the intro, but Talca Park, it must hold very, very special memories for you.
It sure does, yeah. Yeah, I was only there on Saturday playing on the match, actually, for Pride Week. We played against the Dublin Devils Saturday, so it does have a very special place in my heart.
Yeah, I believe Alan Cawley scored a spectacular goal from the halfway line. I mean, he hasn't mentioned it on Twitter or anything yet, but...
he did, in all fairness. He did, in all fairness, score a cracker, yeah, from the halfway line.
Yeah, it was a cracker.
Well, it's just great to get out. You know what? As I said, it was something that I wanted to do as a kid. I remember playing there as a kid when the dressing room was where the main stand is. You know, the dressing rooms used to be there. You know, as a kid growing up, Talca Park was somewhere where you wanted to play. And I was lucky enough then to play, obviously, for a few seasons there with Shelbourne.
Pat, as I said at the very outset of the podcast, I mean, you're synonymous with, you know, so many clubs, but obviously Shelbourne holds a very special place in your heart. And I guess Tulke Park, I mentioned the fact that, you know, it's a famous Dublin venue, but it's just traditionally a famous Irish venue. You know, it rekindles memories like, you know, off Dalyman Park, of Milltown, of Flower Lodge, grounds like that. It's got a special resonance in Irish football, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Like Tony said, there's so many special players have come through and played there, and, you know, even from teams travelling from abroad to play there, it's a brilliant old ground. It's still got that unique where the, you know, crowd is on top of you and it's really tight, compact pitch, and it is a special ground. And, you know, even going, like Tony said, as a schoolboy, even going back to then, I think I first played in Tulke in 1981. I think it was maybe new floodlights were installed, and it was either Liverpool or Manchester United were coming to play, and we were due to play St Kevin's. I think we were under 12 at the time, and someone had dug a big H in the pitch because it was in the middle of the hunger strike, and we thought the game was going to be cancelled. So, like right from then, you know, as young players, that was one of the grounds you wanted to play in. You know, some of the cup finals were played there as well for schoolboy leagues at the time. So, it's a great old ground, and it would be a shame. And I think even just the saving of Tulke is important, but I think also, and I've said this from the start of this process, I'm not sure about Shelbourne moving to Fisburn either. I think Bowes have done so much good work in that area and the surrounding areas. I think it'll be difficult for Shell. So I think it's important that, you know, Shelbourne are recognising this, not just in Tulke, that, you know, there's an area in that side of the north side where it's crying out for a football team from Drumcondra all the way out into North Dublin, North County Dublin, you know, out into the likes of Malahide and Donabate and all them areas. There's huge potential there. So, you know, I think it's important as well from a Shelbourne point of view that they don't get caught up in that moving to Daly Mount and they get lost in that scenario, you know. So I'd love to see it saved and preserved for football, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be fearful that Shelbourne as a club could lose its identity.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, at the end of the day, Shells are really a Southside club in the Ringsend area, you know, and they've now established themselves in that Tulke Park, Drumcondra area, and they do have a support from that, you know, north side of the city. So, you know, I just think Bowes have done so much work. They've been brilliant off the pitch in relation to what they're doing around the Fisbury area and Carbert and Finglas and all them areas, you know. And I just that is a concern for me with Shells going in there, you know. And obviously, I spent a long time, I think it was 9 or 10 years at Shells as a player and as a manager. And they're going in the right direction at the moment. Looks like they're going to get back into the Premier Division. So if it was a case that they get back in and Tulke can be preserved, and obviously, a bit like the Daly Mount project, that it can be used for more than just football. I think that's one of the bigger issues that we had around the League of Ireland grounds, that they were just established as football stadiums. If you think of the likes of Daly Mount and Tulke and Pats, they're all in real confined spaces, but they have huge communities around them, so they had to be used in that regard, not just as football stadiums that are used once every 2 weeks. You know, they had to be used on a regular basis to help the communities in them areas. So I think it would be important from that point of view.
And that's the thing about it, isn't it, Tony, that the Save Tulke campaign, they're keen to see. I mean, obviously, they're conscious of the fact that Shelbourne as a club is buying into the Daily Mount project, but they want to see the ground saved for use by the community and, you know, to be used by the community and saved as something that is very important to the city and to the area.
Yeah, it would, because I'm just thinking there what Pat was saying there, you know. I was just thinking, imagine not having Tulke Park anymore. It would be a strange thing, you know. For me personally, it would be a strange thing. As I'm a Shelbourne fan, you know, and not going up to Tulke Park, you know, and not being there would be really, really strange feeling for me as a football fan, you know. You know, as I said, as Pat said earlier on, like the community work that you do. As I said, we had a game there on Saturday for the Pride Week, you know. And there's other charity matches that I played in. I'm sure Pat has played in a few as well. And, you know, it'd be a shame if it did go. And that's being truthful. Yeah, it would be a shame.
Gary, your thoughts on Tulke Park? Because you were there with Shelbourne for a short time.
Yeah, actually, that's where I started off. And I would have probably shared a dressing room with Pat when he was playing there in, I think it was 1999, 2000. I would have been kind of knocking around and on the bench for a couple of games with the first team. But like the lads say, it would be a shame to lose it. And you think of, you know, Milltown and all the talk about it when it's been lost, and they're still talking about it to this day. So now is the time, I suppose, to get the wheels in motion in order to keep it, because, you know, you don't want to be looking back and having any regrets about it. Like, if it went, at the minute it's still there, and it's important to kind of keep the momentum now and to try and keep it there, so that you're not looking back in 20 years' time talking about it in the same regard that people still talk about Milltown.
Pat, this is probably a hard one for you to answer, but do you have a favourite match or a favourite night from all your years, either as a player or being involved in management at Tulka Park, that stands out, or any special memory, or is that... Are there so many?
Listen, there's brilliant memories, like, as from a playing point of view and obviously a managing point of view. I think it's always very difficult to was there for that long, as you know, and I also played in a B international there, which is probably the highest level, obviously the highest level I played for in my country, against Denmark, and scored. So like I said, I you know, from going back to the schoolboy days right through to when I sort of finished managing with Shelbourne, there's so many special memories, and it would be difficult to highlight any of them, I suppose. Just great memories in general of being around the stadium. And I think people have to be realistic as well. We know if it's a case of that Tulka can be saved, that there's a huge investment needed in it. So obviously that plan, I've seen some of the stuff around that, you know, that has to be taken into consideration. And I think Tommy said, or Gary maybe said as well, that, you know, don't have any regrets on it. See, can we look at right through how it can be developed if it can be saved for football? And I think it'd be really important for Shelbourne as well, as I alluded to earlier. I think it's really important that they stay in that area.
Yeah, but do you think it can pass? Because obviously, as I mentioned, Shelbourne have signed up to the Daily Mount project. Land is expensive, you know. The view is that, you know, the land will be, you know, the ground and the land will be sold off for development.
Yeah, well, listen, I don't know what the deal is in relation to Dalymount. As part of that deal, that the finances that's raised for Tulka helps to develop Dalymount. I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of it. I just think we're sort of ex-players and managers and talking about probably nostalgia a lot of the time. But there's also, I think, we spoke about League of Ireland clubs. We spoke about what the Job Rovers have done in the community in Tallaght. We spoke about what Bowers are doing in that area of north inner city and out into the likes of Finglas and Carbrae, which are really important for working class areas. You know, I don't think this is any different for Tulka. Can it be used as a football stadium? Absolutely, and an amenity for the people. You know, there's a huge population, don't forget, from that area there right out into North Dublin, and you know, it's a massive catchment area, and the work can be done to bring them people and get them involved in the game. Well, then, you know, it's like I say, Pats do the same in Inchicore. I think it's probably something that's dropped off with Pats, you know, probably since the Pat Dolan days, but I think they can get back to that, because again, it's an area that they're synonymous with. So I think we've all spoke about this before, that League of Ireland clubs have to be part of a community. You know, and here we are taking one club out of a thriving community as well. So I think everything has to be looked into. Finances is obviously a huge part of this. But from my point of view, I'd love to see a save for Shelbourne to continue to play there.
And Tony, it's hard for anybody, of a certain age anyway, to pass Tulka Park without thinking of Ollie Byrne, the force of nature that was Ollie Byrne, who sadly passed away a few years ago. But Tulka Park as a ground and Shelbourne as a club meant so much to him.
Yeah, definitely. Ollie was Shelbourne through and through, you know. Everything he done for the club, you know, everything was about Shelbourne, you know. And as Pat alluded to earlier on, like, you know, it would be a really big shame if we were to lose Tulka Park. As I said, as a kid growing up, you know, that's what you wanted to do, was play in Tulka Park, you know. And the fan base is brilliant as well, you know, and the fans are absolutely 100% behind trying to keep Tulka Park, you know. And as Pat said, the north side of Dublin, the south side, you know, it's all about getting people into the grounds, watching matches, you know. So, you know, Tulka Park would be a great place, you know, to go and watch a match. I love going over and watching the game. So, you know, it'd be a shame, again, as I said, if we lose the place.
Yeah, your own special days, of course, Tony, with Shelbourne, the two cup wins, 96 and 97, the equaliser against Pats, was that 96, wasn't it, the equaliser, and then you went on to win the replay.
96, yeah.
Yeah, that was a special goal, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. A special day, as I thought said, you can't pick out one in particular, but, you know, every game that we play, like the European night, obviously, Pat Hadby with the Shelbourne boys that were there in Deportivo Locarino, all that era, you know. So, you know, there's special memories for everyone in Talbot Park. You know, as I said, I remember playing there as a 14-year-old or 14, playing against the famous Home Farm team that went through all the years not being unbeaten. You know, the likes of Gary Teddy, Graham Kavanagh, you know, playing them in the final of a cup. You know, just to play in Talbot Park, it was special. You know, as a kid growing up, that's what you wanted to do.
Are you still involved in any level of football at all these days, Tony? Or
yeah, I'm with Lourdes. I'm with Lourdes Celtic. I do the under 12s, going under 13s this year, this season. So that's what I'm doing. You know, I'd love to get involved at a higher level, but unfortunately, at the moment, nothing has materialised. But I really would love to go higher. You know, in a league one team or something.
Okay.
No offers have been given to me, so I enjoy Lourdes, as I said. I'm a Lourdes Celtic man as well, and okay. My family all as well, right. But a Lourdes man.
Well, listen, we wish you the very best of luck in all of that, and thanks for joining us, and thanks for sharing your memories of Talca Park. And as Pat said a few moments ago, Shelburne going so well in the First Division, 8 points clear at the top of the table, 1-0 winners over Wexford at the weekend, Georgie Poynton scoring from the penalty spot, Athlone Town 0, Cork City 2, Byrne and Baxter with the goals, Bray with a very good win over UCD by 4-0, Joe Doyle scoring twice in that game, and Treaty United, they've been terrific this season, winning 2-0 at Cove Ramblers on Saturday evening, Charlie Fleming and Matthew McKevitt with the goals for Treaty United, who lie second in the table. It's looking good, Pat, for Shelburne in terms of promotion. I mean, it's still early in the season, a long, long way to go, but 8 points up, it's a great position to be in.
Yeah, it's a fabulous position to be in. They're motoring at the moment. It's sluggish enough start. Changed their system, playing with three early in the season, and changed that to a flat back four, and I think that's helped them. And top end of the pitch, they've got a bit of quality for that league as well. And I think, like I said, the fact that they got relegated would have hurt a lot of people around Hulk, and they've invested in the team again, and they're going in the right direction. And please God, they get back into the Premier Division, because that's where they really belong. You know, Shelbourne Football Club should be playing Premier Division football, and hopefully they will be next season.
Okay, and just before we wrap things up, Pat, a bit of news breaking. Scottish midfielder Billy Gilmore has tested positive for coronavirus and will have to isolate for 10 days. So that's a big loss for Scotland ahead of the Croatia game, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's the worst news that you can get, I suppose, in a tournament like that. And you've got all, because I know from being involved at Linfield, all the protocols that go around COVID-19. So it's a huge blow to them. And hopefully that's the only one in the camp and there's no one else has to self-isolate. So, yeah, massive blow to him because he was so good against England.
Okay. All right, listen, lads, we leave it there. Pat, many thanks for joining us. And also to Gary Rogers. Until the next time, from me, Adrian Eames, and all the team, bye-bye.